Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome back to New Books in Latino Studies. I'm David James Gonzalez, the host of the channel, and today I'm speaking with Mario Jimenez Cifuentes, author of the brand new book, Forests and Fields, Mexican Labor in the Pacific Northwest, just released this month by Rutgers University Press. Dr. Cifuentes is an assistant professor of history. Welcome back to New Books in Latino Studies. I'm David James Gonzalez, the host of the channel, and today I'm speaking with Mario Jimenez Cifuentes, author of the brand new book, Forests and Fields, Mexican Labor in the Pacific Northwest, just released this month by Rutgers University Press. Dr. Cifuentes is an assistant professor of history at the University of California, Merced, where he teaches courses on immigration, labor, food, and music. Professor Cifuentes' research has focused on comparative immigration and labor history and has been funded by the UC Humanities Research Institute and the Andrew W. Mellon Foundation. Hello, Mario, and welcome to New Books in Latino Studies.
Hey, how are you doing?
Doing great. And I'm glad that you're on with us. I've been excited to read your book since I was introduced to it at last year's Western History Association conference. So I'm glad. And it is my understanding that it was just released this month in March. Is that right?
It came out on March 3rd, I believe.
There we go. Great. Well, I was hoping you can begin our conversation today by telling us a little bit about your personal background and your pathway to becoming a professor of labor and immigration history.
My parents are immigrant farm workers from Mexico, from the state of Coahuila. Their families have been coming to the United States as farm workers. From what I can find, from as early as the 1940s, 1950s, my mom's grandfather, my mom's father was a bracero, and they started coming to Oregon, Washington, Idaho, 50 or 60 years ago. And so my parents doing the same thing. They came to Oregon, where I was born. I was born in Napa, Idaho, during one of their treks up north. I was pretty much raised in a migrant family until I was about 12, 13 years old. And then my parents got more steady jobs, no longer in the field, and grew up in the town called Ontario, Oregon, which is on the border of Oregon and Idaho, out in eastern Oregon, a very rural community, farm working community, so like onions, potatoes, sugar beets, things like that. From there, you know, once we settled, I think I became sort of a much better student, got much more involved in sort of academics in that sense, and I wanted to go to college, and I used to hate working in the fields. I hated it. And my mom always used to say, "Hey, working in the fields, you better be reading." So I think from there, I started to like read a lot and wanted to go to school, wanted to go to college. And from there, you know, it was sort of nobody in my family had gone to college before, and that was sort of new to me and new to, you know, my family. But I did end up getting an academic scholarship to the University of Oregon.
Mm-hmm.
Oregon and Eugene. From there, I stayed there to do a master's. I wasn't really kind of ready, I think, or even understood what it meant to be in graduate school.
Right.
And so master's was sort of a way of like kind of feeling it out and be like, okay, is this something that I want to do? Is this something that I'm good at, you know? And after my first semester of graduate school, I was pretty convinced that this was something that I wanted to do and that I was pretty good at it too. And so from there, I did my master's at Oregon and then went to Brown University to do my PhD with Matt Garcia. So I went to go work with Matt over there at Brown.
And what was it that, essentially first put it in your mind to, not just pursue, a PhD, but to actually, become a historian and, scholar?
Funny because, when I was a kid, like I said, I began to read a lot. And by the time I was a teenager, I had been picking up a lot of very political books. And I blame Rage Against the Machine for this, right?
Yeah.
Because as a kid, I was watching MTV one day and there was a video of a song called The People of the Sun. I don't know if you're familiar
yes,
with that.
Yes, I am.
This is a great video and it like keeps like, it's a lot of flashing images and it's very busy. And, there was pictures of stuff like three stars and the Mexican flag and indigenous people and all this stuff. And in my head, I was like, who are these guys? And what are these white boys singing about Mexico for? Right.
Right.
And I didn't know Mexican by that time. I just
right.
associated, with like heavy metal with like white kids. Right. And so I was like, why are these white kids singing about Mexico? I'm so confused by this. And so I went out and I bought the album. And I don't know if you know this, but if you take the insert of Evil Empire out, the insert is a picture of just books scattered on a table.
Mm-hmm.
And that table is like Fanon, Che, and like all these kind of like post-colonial, like books about Lumumba and different people. And I started to just devour this stuff, and I was like reading it. I read Fanon the first time. When I was 14 years old, it was the first time I read Fanon. And, I didn't really understand what it was, but I knew that it was revolutionary. It was something that I really, like, spoke to me, right?
Right.
But even in all, right, there was very little about, like, Latinos, right? There was very little in that literature about what my experience was. And then what I did find was focused always on California and on Texas, right?
Right.
And so I just kept asking myself that question, why are we here? Why are we here? How did we end up getting here? And at first it kind of started out as like a very esoteric question for me. I started reading a lot of like religious texts and philosophical texts. And I remember when I first got to the University of Oregon, I was a religious studies major because mm-hmm. that was kind of how I was going to answer that question for myself. And I think that happens a lot with young people. It's like, it becomes a very internalized idea, right? Instead of thinking of these sort of socio-political, economic forces that put you where you're at, we tend to kind of like, when we're young, tend to look inwards, right? And that's
right.
What I was doing. I just study stuff. I was sort of trying to figure out this kind of esoteric question about why I was there. And it wasn't until I met this, great professor named Daniel Goldrich at the University of Oregon, who was this kind of emeritus professor who did Latin American politics, who, talked about NAFTA and these other things in a class, that I started to think about, that these were external forces that kind of brought my family to work in this like random place in the middle of the desert or, of Eastern Oregon. And it just sort of kept, I kept wanting to try to answer that question. And even with that information, even with understanding how, free trade works or all these other things, there was still very little available about why the Northwest, right? Why Ontario, Oregon? Why Hermiston, Oregon? Why Yakima, Washington? Why these different places? And so even when I got to school, I remember having this conversation with Matt Garcia, who was a professor at Oregon at the time, about whether or not I was going to go to graduate school. I had been very active as an organizer for PCUM, actually, as a student organizer for the Farm Workers Union in Oregon. I had been very active on student politics and student activism. on campus activism. And so there was this kind of moment where I was going to go to work for this this organization that was sort of anti-prison and part of the anti-prison movement.
Mm-hmm.
It was my senior year in college, and I was sort of deciding what I was going to do. And Matt Garcia told me, he was like, what are you going to do? Are you going to go to graduate school? Are you going to go take this job? And I was like, well, I don't know. I'm kind of in the air about all of this. And he said to me, if you don't take this job, working in this prison moratorium project or whatever, will somebody else do it? And I was like, yeah, I'm sure. There's plenty of people who are qualified and passionate about this subject that surely would do it. And then he goes, if nobody writes this book about farm workers in the Northwest, if you don't write this, who else is going to write it?
Right, right.
Nobody, right? I mean, this has not been done before, and I didn't know a lot of people, from my community that were going to college, let alone going to graduate school. And so that kind of that hit really close to home. I was 22 years old. I was, trying to decide what I was going to do with my life. And it just all made so much sense to me at that point, right? That what I was doing or what I could potentially do as a graduate student was a form of activism, a form of commitment to my community that I could show in a way that perhaps other people couldn't, right? I was like, what am I good at? I'm a good writer, I'm a good researcher, I can do this, and I can write this book that would be something new. And, and here we are, that was like 2000, 2002, and it's, 15, 16 years later, and finally, it's been done, finally.
Right. Thanks for sharing that. That's really neat to hear, the background of, not just how you come to the subject, but how you make that decision. And it's always great to hear of, the very influential mentors and academics in one's background that points you in such a long different path and helps you to understand what's possible, and I have a number of those people in my background as well that I'm really appreciative towards. So this book for you is really close to home. Clearly it built, I believe, out of your dissertation project. And, I was wondering if you could start our discussion of the book by explaining a bit the title, which really interests me, and particularly making the connection of the importance of people and place in U.S. labor, Latino, and environmental history in the space that you're talking about, because you really are merging those three genres, if you will, academic genres and or literatures. And so can you speak a bit about, the place that you're writing on and how the title really kind of encapsulates part of what you're doing?
Yeah, absolutely. So I think part of what, makes the Northwest unique, right, is sort of its kind of history as this environmental kind of model, right? I mean, there's an environmental movement that arises out of the Northwest that kind of sets the tone for the environmental movement across the country, emerging in the 70s. And so I think, to me, one of the things that the environmental studies and environmental movement in general have sort of ignored for many years was race and labor, right? And part of the inspiration for this comes from an organization that was on campus at the University of Oregon called the Coalition Against Environmental Racism. And they held this annual conference every year on campus and really sort of introduced me to the idea of environmental racism. And it was something that I started to see very prolific across the Northwest, right? And so I started to kind of thinking about, these spaces that I had previously sort of taken for granted, and I think most people take for granted, like the National Forest, right? As this, when we think of it as a preserve, we think of it as having always been there, mm-hmm. And having kind of naturally occurring phenomena. But what I started to realize as I was looking at these different communities in the Northwest was that the forest itself was a crop, right? And it was treated like a crop. It's thinned, it's planted, it's replanted, it's sprayed, it's harvested, it's all these things. And the labor that is normally associated with the forests tends to be this very white labor, this kind of lumberjack, sawmill, lumber mill kind of image, right? Even in labor studies, we look at the IWW had a very strong foothold in the Northwest, has this kind of very masculine white space. And the more I started thinking about the ways in which the forest is treated as a crop, I started seeing that, well, really, it's, you know, it's Mexicans that replant, it's Mexicans that thin, it's Mexicans that are spraying. They're, you know, and essentially they're doing the exact same work that they're doing in, you know, strawberries or in you know, onions or potatoes or whatever else. And so I really felt like this was a really kind of important thing to look at, especially because the audience for the kind of work that we do tend to be more narrow. And trying to sort of take on this idea of environmental studies and environmental history and forcing people to kind of open up their lens a little bit, I thought was really, really important.
I agree completely. I forget where it was. You make the point a number of times, and I think very early in the book, in the introduction perhaps, and then throughout. But when you make the point that the forests were, you know, a crop, just like, you know, any other kind of stoop labor crop that is so commonly associated with Mexican labor history, you know, it really helped me to envision, as you say, in the forest and environment history very differently. I mean, you refer to the work of William Cronin and Richard White in the book, of, you know, done some great work in environmental history, particularly in the Northwest and in other parts of the country. It's really shaped the direct environmental history. But your assertion and connection here, and of course, their input was is that naturally the environment isn't just, you know, natural and you know, organically developed the way that we see it now. It's, of course, it's been shaped through thousands of years of human intervention. And so I always got that. But then again, your point of, you know, really that the forests were, are a crop, and that the real connection between the two is, at least for you in this region, is there was the same labor that was used to both, you know, service and harvest, if you will, the forest as it was the various fields and crops, whether they be sugar beets or strawberries throughout the Northwest. So that was a very striking point for me, and I appreciate that you bring it forward so clearly early on, you know, it's just made clear as the rest of the book focuses on Mexican labor, and in particular, you know, how they resist the structures that you've already referred to initially, the structures that brought various populations and movements or migrations of ethnic Mexicans to the region, and throughout. And so the book starts with that. It starts with the Bracero program in the Pacific Northwest. And I wonder if you would speak a bit about the Bracero program and how it functioned and what it looked like in the Northwest, because so much of what I've read has focused on the Southwest, and there's been a bit of work that I've talked about Braceros in the Midwest and to a lesser extent to other parts of the country. But mostly it's a Southwest kind of story narrative. So tell us what it was like in the Northwest. How did it begin and how did it kind of develop?
Yeah, I think, you know, there's a very distinct sort of difference, right, in the various Bracero programs. Right? We tend to think of it as like one major program, but the different nuances in the laws that change make for a very different program at very different times. And so one of the things that I wanted to do was, I mean, obviously sort of going into this project, I was not somebody who was a fan of the Bracero program. I felt it was exploitative and problematic, and I still feel that way. But at the same time, when I began to interview Braceros who were working in the Northwest at that particular moment in time, they talked about the exploitation for sure, but they talked about so many other things, right? And they talked about the resistance, and they talked about fighting, and they talked about how much fun they had. And that was something that was not squaring with the kind of traditional narrative that I had of the Bracero program. And so I started sort of thinking about, okay, why do they feel differently, right? And I even had interviews where people were like, yeah, I was in the program in Arizona and I hated it. And when I went to Oregon, it was different. And I was like, okay, well then what's different, right? What's happening here that for them was different? Mm-hmm. And it's a number of different things, right? One is the distance, right? And like the ways in which the program operated at the time made, you know, the growers responsible for transport. And so it was very expensive to bring in Braceros from the border all the way out to the Northwest every time you had a labor problem, right? And so what ended up being cheaper for them was just to pay people more. And so, you know, the Braceros would talk about, often talk about having an impromptu sit down and getting a raise and then going back to work, right? And so I was like, I'd never heard this before. Right. It's not something that happened in California. It was not something that happened in Arizona, you know? And so to me, that was like this really valuable story to sort of think about that place matters, right? That distance matters. The other thing that came up a lot because of place was the lack of a Mexican American community in the Northwest made it easier and more difficult for them in a couple of ways, right? It made it more difficult for them because it was harder for them to sort of skip out on contracts and find other alternative work that did exist in, like, let's say Southern California, for instance. But the lack of that also made them have a lot more interactions with Anglo communities that I don't think would have happened in other places. I don't think did happen in other places, where there was this longer history of sort of strict segregation that existed in California and Texas, for instance. And so one of the things that I found that was really interesting was that even after they were out of the program, or even after the Barcelona program was over, they kept coming back to the Northwest, which is exactly what my grandfather did. Mm-hmm. He kept coming back because it was different from South Texas. It was uniformly different. You know, it was different from California. And this is not in any way trying to minimize the suffering or the difficulty of a labor contract program. But I wanted to give it some nuance, right? I wanted to give people some voice and some agency in all of this and say, you know, they came to the Northwest specifically because it wasn't the Bracero program in the South, right? And I think that's a way of sort of just making this a little bit more nuanced, right? It's like there's a lot of doom and gloom in the kind of work that we do. And to me, I felt like, you know, sure, there's not like wholesale like organizing against the Bracero program or, you know, union organizing in the 50s and 60s, but there's all these ways in which people are resisting and which people are making their lives better for themselves as much as possible. And so I just wanted to kind of talk about those stories that I had been told. You know, it's not something that I had any intention of coming to tell that story.
Mm-hmm.
My trainee had sort of thought that this was a terrible, you know, like the quote says, right, close to slavery type of program. And the reality of it was is that while all those things were true, these men also found an incredible amount of joy and an incredible amount of freedom in what I thought was a very, very oppressive institution.
Right, right. And so we have the actual numbers of braceros are lower, smaller, clearly in the Northwest than they were in the Southwest. And you mentioned the lack of, you know, established Mexican or ethnic Mexican communities, you know, that were able to receive these braceros and thereby that they, you know, they didn't have the opportunity as they did in the Southwest to integrate into those types of communities. So they essentially had to make their own. But you also mentioned that wages were better in the Northwest, right? And also, actually, forms of worker resistance, like strikes, were more successful. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, they were more successful and more prevalent. And again, I think it has everything to do with the distance. I think it has everything to do with the growers having a certain amount of restriction on them in the early years of the program. So I want to make sure that that's clarified, right? By the time that the war is over, the Northwest almost completely gets out of importing workers from Mexico.
Mm-hmm.
To them, it's no longer kind of cost efficient. There's this really great quote that I found in one of our newspapers where one of the farmer's wives is talking about how the longer they stay here, the more problematic they are, right? And so we need to recycle workers more often and even faster than, you know, the program will allow. And so, you know, they get out of it fairly quickly because these workers, the more often they went on strike, or I should say the first time they would go on strike, they would then start to go on strike more and more often. And we would see it regularly. And then, you know, some of the stories that I tell in the book is, you know, a group of strikers will come in, a group of settlers will come in from another place in Idaho that they want a wage increase at, and they would strike at the new place that they showed up at and would win a wage increase there. And so, you know, there was this kind of radicalization that took place with Bracero's in the Northwest that we don't really see in other places. And again, I think it has everything to do with the fact that, you know, they were far away from home. They were far away from, you know, any Mexican-American community sneak off to, that they could skip out on their contract. And then there's also a very real kind of struggle between agribusiness and small business and small farmers in Oregon and Idaho and in Washington. You know, California, from its inception, has essentially been an agribusiness state. You know, there's not the myth of the small farmer just doesn't exist in California, but mm-hmm. it did in Oregon. And so, you know, the family farmers would actually provide an avenue of escape for some of the Braceros who were contracted through large agribusiness. So I think there's a number of different factors that really led to that. You know, I talk about, you know, small farmers who would hire people away that would pay enough wages for Braceros to be able to buy a car, right? Mm-hmm. So you had those who became essentially undocumented workers by skipping out on their contracts and, you know, going to work at various different farmers who weren't big enough to merit importing workers from the Bracero program. And so I'm not sure how much your listeners or how much you're familiar with that, but essentially, you know, if I was a small farmer and I made a request to the Department of Labor for 10 Braceros, it would never get approved.
Right.
And so what farmers, they would get together in co-ops or put an order in, quote unquote, for 100 Braceros or 200 Braceros, and those would be more likely to get approved. And so small farmers would essentially, you know, what they would call bootlegging workers away from the large agribusiness. And so that tension also created a space for maneuverability for Braceros.
Exactly. You know, and the story is usually, you know, you get used to when I'm reading, you know, various histories of similar experiences, whether it's Braceros or, you know, Mexican labor in different parts of the country, there's always differences to degree, and sometimes it's, you know, larger or smaller than others. But this was a space where there are quite some substantial differences between how the Bracero program functioned in other parts of the country, and I found it incredibly interesting. You also bring up in this chapter another way of resistance that Braceros used was simply by, you know, claiming space and challenging social mores. Can you speak on that for a little bit?
Yeah, this is another thing that I thought was really, really fascinating when I was doing the interviews, and not something at all that I expected to come across. And then, you know, once they pointed me to different things, I was able to corroborate a lot of the stories and newspaper articles and things like that. But, you know, they created this kind of social space, you know, initially the sort of dances and going into town and, you know, going, talking to women and these sort of interracial relationships that developed with some of the women in these small towns was really, really fascinating to me. It was just something that I didn't expect to see at all. And something that I think humanizes Braceros, because again, I think the narrative of the Bracero program at this point has become very, very dark. And again, while those things most certainly existed, and I don't want to minimize them, I do want to say that Braceros were people, right? And they were young men for the most part, and they were out there trying to create some kind of feeling of belonging, whether that was flirting or dancing or you know, creating, having, you know, patriotic holidays or whatever different methods that came up. It was something that happened, and I wanted to kind of tell that story as a way of saying, you know, like, it was an interesting kind of moment, because once you got them talking about, you know, some of the things that they did for fun, their faces would light up and they would tell these great stories, and you're just like, man, there's something not jiving here, right, between kind of what I normally think and what's actually happening here. And eventually I sort of came to this idea that, like, yeah, this is how they resisted, right? This is how they made, some joy, created some joy in their lives and created a way of owning their own bodies and owning their own space. Whether it was like dancing with white women or going dancing or swimming with them or having a patriotic dance or whatever, raising the Mexican flag on one of the labor camps. It was just this kind of way of claiming space that I hadn't heard about before.
Certainly. And it was neat to see both in the social sphere and in the, work and more public sphere to see, these various ways that these braceros were exercising their agency. And that certainly comes across very clearly. You mentioned that after the war, that the bracero program essentially is ended in the Northwest. And part of that is, due to the fact that a lot of the growers are kind of sick of the braceros in that they've been successful in striking and challenging the wage structure and it's become a bit irritating for them. But that doesn't bring about an end to Mexican labor. In fact, what you say is that, the braceros strike off a migration stream, if you will, of ethnic Mexican labor that continues after the war, but from a different source. It comes then after the war from Texas. And so there's a part of the Tejano diaspora that Mark Rodriguez also speaks about, but his diaspora goes, he's mostly speaking of the Texas to Wisconsin Midwest connection. You identify another connection here to the Northwest. So can you talk a bit about how this new migration of ethnic Mexicans after the war differs from, the braceros and how essentially they begin to what are the experiences of Tejano migrants in Oregon and how they adjust to the social and economic system there?
Absolutely. Yeah, I think this chapter is very much in the spirit of Mark Rodriguez's book, in that we identify basically the same factors, right? I mean, the Bracero program, while it ends in Oregon, doesn't stop affecting Oregon, right? Because Braceros are in a much more dire situation. Mexico has a lot less leverage in the Bracero program than it did during the war. That state like Texas, which had previously been blacklisted from importing Braceros because of their history of discrimination against Mexicans, is now allowed to import Mexicans into the United States. And they start to sort of, push out Mexican Americans from various jobs in the fields in South Texas. And so that starts to push, Tejanos further and further north into the Cotton Belt and then finally into, like, the Midwest, Northeast, and the Pacific Northwest. And so we're talking about very much the same migration and the same forces that are working in South Texas. And then by the get to Oregon and Washington and Idaho, I was sort of, when I first started writing the dissertation, I was looking for evidence of strikes and evidence of labor unrest and all these different things, and I really couldn't find anything. And I kind of like had a very sort of narrow vision of what it meant to resist oppression when I first started writing this. And the more Tejanos that I started to speak with and the more people that I started to interview, the more that I realized that they were challenging this kind of racial hierarchy in a very different way than I expected, right? This kind of labor, the way that labor is organized in a very different way. And one of the stories that always sticks out in my head is the fight that Menchaca gets into with the police officer at the drive-in. And when he told me that story, I mean, my jaw was on the floor. Like, I couldn't believe it. He's like, I was like, would you have been able to get away with that in Texas? And he's like, man, they would have lynched me in Texas.
Right.
So I was like, this is fabulous, right? This is such a great story where, he knows that it's a racist place, but he knows that it's less racist than South Texas, right? And so he exercises that kind of masculinity in a very different way than he would have in Texas, and he found it incredibly liberating, right? And that's not to say that, again, that that this is a a racial utopia. There was, you know, the Mercedes sisters would always talk about the kind of discrimination they felt in school, and you know, the first time that they were called a stick, and like different things like that that obviously still exist in these rural communities. But one where it wasn't quite as dangerous, you know, and they too, you know, were sort of expressing and claiming their space in very cultural ways through the dance halls. And I felt like that was a really important story to tell, as a way of kind of challenging the kind of traditional narrative of labor history where like there's this organization, you know, there's this oppression, they organize, they strike, and then usually they lose, right? And, like, things are all still terrible. And so, like, to me, I was like, well, this kind of story is a little bit different. I wanted to kind of break up that narrative of that kind of traditional labor history where, you know, there was no big strike with the Tejanos. There was no big union movement with the Tejanos. But there was, you know, carnicerías and tortillerías and quinceañeras and bilingual radio, and like there were all these things that came into the Northwest in the 1950s that weren't there before. And so there was a way in which this whole area is transformed and mm-hmm. it's reshaped, it's a completely different cultural space. And I think one of the things that I love about this chapter is that the Japanese are a huge part of that.
Yeah. Yeah, that's something I was actually gonna bring up. That I found that completely fascinating. You know, the role of, you know, Nisi farmers and ranchers in, if you will, aiding right Tejano migrants to settle and form community by you know, allowing them to use some of their own spaces and buildings. Can you speak just a little bit you know, about that? I mean, that was just an amazing story.
Yeah, I grew up in this town there, and I didn't know this story, right? You know, it's like fascinating to me. And the more I started digging into it, the more like I found pictures of 1940s and 1950s, Ontario, Oregon, where an entire street is nothing but Japanese businesses.
Right.
You know, and now it's completely foreign to me. I was like, why aren't people in Minidoka in this time? Why are, you know, like how are they able to hang on to all these things? And so, you know, there was this amazing story of this, you know, kind of community that embraces the Japanese. And they had long history there. They had a long time there. They were far enough away from the actual coast that Mount Hiro County became a safe zone and had the largest number of free Japanese during the war of any other place in the United States. And, you know, we're talking about, like, there's two Buddhist temples in the Northwest, one in Seattle and one in Ontario, Oregon.
Right.
Which is a town, at that time, a town of about 7,000 people. Right. And, you know, there's a huge Japanese temple, Buddhist temple there. There's a tofu factory there. There's all this kind of such a strong Japanese presence. And so after the war, you know, the Japanese are facing extreme, you know, still facing discrimination from other farmers and from other people in the community that they start to kind of find their own niche in growing, right? They can't grow potatoes. They can't break into the large grower co-ops and organizations that exist that are largely Anglo-dominated in the sugar beet industry, which is, you know, dominated by, you know, white satin I'm forgetting the name of the company right now, but you know, it's dominated by agribusiness, mm-hmm. and then the potato industry is dominated by you know, white co-ops, and the Japanese, you know, get into onions. And onions at the time are a very niche crop. They don't sell great volumes, and the Japanese begin to, you know, get into that, but what becomes really important for Mexicans is that they not only get into the growing, they start to open cooperative packing sheds, right? And so the packing sheds start to provide year-round work for the Mexicans, or for the Tejanos in particular. And so the migration chain kind of stops there, right? And so you have the first kind of settled communities of Tejanos who are working not only in the onions during the growing season, but they're working in packaging and processing sheds during the winter months that allows them to stay around year round. And that really, really sort of begins to be, the moment when the Tejano starts to stop moving. The other kind of component to that is that the Japanese offer two things that are really valuable that Anglos don't offer. One, they start to rent to Mexicans, right? And so Mexicans no longer have to live in labor camps. They are able to rent property from Japanese landholders. And then they also start to utilize this space called the Japanese Hall, which is where the Nisei would hold, you know, their kind of bazaars, their judo tournaments, their various different kind of cultural celebrations, and they would rent it out for quinceañeras. And they had a baseball diamond, which, again, the baseball was very big with the Nisei, when they started to rent the baseball diamonds out to Mexican, different Mexican labor camps that would compete against each other in these tournaments. So the Japanese play a really, really huge role in being able to make that transition for Mexicans from migrant community to a more permanent community.
Yes. Now, again, this is a fascinating chapter and a really, I think, unique example, particularly for the time period, you know, the post-war era. And in a number of other studies, you know, there's often the point made about intercultural or interethnic interactions, with ethnic Mexican laborers and their families, with either Anglos or, usually it's primarily Anglos in the Southwest in regards to similar things, using, social spaces and their attempt to build community. But this one, again, I found was very unique and just fascinating. So that brings us to really the middle chapters of the book. The first two focus on these initial two migrations, first the Braceros and then the Tejanos. Chapters 3 and 4, and really the rest of the book, focuses more on the organizations that emerge to defend and organize Mexican laborers and their families in the region. And so the first of those, groups, or maybe massive, widespread type of movements to do this, was the Willamette Valley Immigration Project. Will you discuss the rise of the WVIP, and in particular, talk a little bit about its founders and influences, where they kind of came from and what they brought to the Valley?
Yeah, I think this is the kind of the moment where, like, the Chicano movement comes to the Northwest, right? And it comes to the Northwest through these three different people, Ramon Rodriguez and Cipriano Ferrero, the sort of the two big ones, right? Cipriano's a really interesting story. He was born here, just south of here in Delano. He's friends with the Chavez family. Him and Linda go to school together. They're in the same grade. He's part of the initial boycott campaign in Detroit. But for some reason, I think he just sort of felt, well, I know the reason, right? I mean, part of it is kind of like, problems that are sort of happening in the UFW internally, and he sort of becomes disillusioned a little bit. And it's something that he was very private about. He didn't really like to talk about a lot of the things that were happening within the UFW that pushed him out. And it's something that even to this day, Bickle is sort of, iffy on being too upfront about. But he comes to Oregon. He actually goes to the University of Oregon, enrolls at the University of Oregon. And he, while he's down there, he discovers this place called Colegio Cesar Chavez, which was this kind of experimental college in Mount Angel, Oregon, whose motto was, college without walls. And so the idea was that you were going to give people real life experience, real life experience credit for that experience, while also, learning some more kind of traditional liberal arts kind of schooling, with the idea that it was going to produce these kind of hybrid Chicanos, right? Like people who came from the community but had professional skills and were able to kind of create wholesale change on a large scale. And, this kind of, it's the first, Chicano serving or Hispanic serving institution of the time.
Mm-hmm.
Really sort of supposed to be this, this really kind of amazing transformative place. So Cipriano drops out of the University of Oregon and goes and enrolls at Gregorio Cesar Chavez, where he meets this other guy, Ramon Ramirez, who's from East L.A., who is very involved with, organizations in East L.A., in particular CASA, and Burke Corona's CASA. And he, is part of the Chicano moratorium. He experiences, firsthand the kind of police brutality and violence that is visited upon that community. His sister's husband is deported. And so he has this kind of, there's all these kind of things happening around him that he is very passionate about and very, motivated to talk about and start a movement around. And so he goes to college at University of Washington, and he does the same thing. He enrolls at UW. He hears about Colegio Cesar Chavez. He takes a group of machistas down to Colegio Cesar Chavez, and he decides this is the place to be. I'm dropping out of UW. I'm going to Colegio Cesar Chavez. And so, sorry, it's not UW. It's another, I forget the name of the school. But he ends up in Washington, and he decides to leave there and go to Colegio Cesar Chavez. And there, they meet up with a bunch of other very prominent activists and other, people from AIM and people from the Puerto Rican nationalist organizations. He meets up with a guy named Raki Barilla, who, becomes an important player in sort of the immigration law history later on. And they start to kind of hash out these, brainstorming sessions about, what do we do? How do we fix this problem? And what's the biggest problem facing, Oregon right now? And they never say this explicitly, but in some ways, I feel like part of the reason that they choose Oregon or they decide to work in Oregon is because they had seen some of the failures that had happened in the movement in other places mm-hmm. and wanted to recreate Oregon that was different, right? And so, they're very specifically from the very beginning pro-immigrant, right? And that's something that a lot of the organizations that they had worked with in the past were not. And so they are, and they have a very internationalist critique, which some of the Chicano organizations that they came from did not have, right? Mm-hmm. There's this very kind of purposeful, kind of outlining of a movement that was more progressive, that was more inclusive, that in some ways was more radical. And they used this space as this kind of launching point. And, there's this great Larry Kleinman, who is this, young Jewish activist from Chicago who moves out to the Northwest to work for the National Lawyers Guild, which is, again, a progressive, community of legal professionals. He comes out and he tells this great story about the first time that they decide to have a meeting about, what to do about the INS. And so they go out and they advertise this and they're trying to get a bunch of people to come. And they go to the Colegio Cesar Chavez and nobody shows up. nobody showed up. And he's not a single farm worker was there. And he's and that's when they're okay, we're doing this wrong, right? Mm-hmm. We're not doing this. We need to be in the communities. And so from the very beginning, I think there was this kind of very strong emphasis on who's the community, what do they need, and how are we going to get it to them, right? And as opposed to being, more philosophically driven or, or more theologically driven, I guess is the word I'm looking for. They're very much about responding to the needs of the community. And I think that's something that they've done for the last 40 years. That has made them successful and, long-lasting.
Certainly, yeah. You bring out, there's a number of things that I liked about the discussion of the WVIP, which eventually transitions to PECUN, or the Piñeros y Campesinos Unidos Noroeste, which is the organization that takes up chapters 5 and 6. But the two things that really interested me was the things that they borrowed from their backgrounds, and part of that really was a kind of study group collaborative atmosphere to try to brainstorm and figure out how to address the problems that for the population that they're primarily concerned with, which at this point is, you mentioned immigrants, and it's undocumented immigrants primarily. And so they initially make this effort to defend undocumented immigrants against deportation proceedings. You know, there are raids that are occurring and they're being deported, and so they come up with a really novel legal strategy using the Fifth Amendment, referring to the right to due process, to and encouraging and teaching undocumented immigrants not to self-incriminate themselves. That is, again, really novel at the time, but really focused, again, on ways that they were trying to figure out how to help these people. And then initially they transitioned to more of a type of labor focus, while still, you know, the WVIP, not yet transitioned to PECUN, but focused on reforestation workers, which really creates that link that the title refers to of forests and fields, and these two, different, with seemingly different types of work, but that are very similar in the way that you're using similar kinds of labor and there's similar processes in you're trying to produce these various crops. And so there's the study group atmosphere, but then there's the very keen focus on the community. And that seems to me something that you identify early on as a distinction, because you emphasize from chapters 3 and 4 on how these organizations borrowed from their past and a number of connections to the UFW, but then and CASA, but then also how they were markedly different. And one of those was this determination to really keep close to the people, really community type of, you know, grassroots focus of making sure that they were pushing for and solving the needs of people and not an organization, which is something that we, at least in a lot of the scholarship on the UFW, seems to be the disconnect. At least a lot of the scholarship in the UFW focuses from the top down. So at least on the top down, there seems to be this focus to preserve the union and the movement at all costs. But with the WVIP and with PECUN, it's really this continually, you know, self-reevaluative process where the organizers are changing tactics and strategies and really to making sure that they're keeping their organization on, you know, the beat of the needs of the community. Right.
And I think that partly has to do with the very different backgrounds of the three different founders, right? It's like, you have somebody like Larry who has a very legal mind, right? He's always sort of thinking about, you know, different angles of the law and how this can work and what might not be able to work. And Witt early on was a big part of it as well. And she was obviously a lawyer and somebody who had that kind of mind as well. You know, Ramon came from a much more like, you know, urban experience, you know, this Chicano experience. And, you know, you see that later on with, their decision to sort of take on the police as well. And then Cipriano with the UFW has this kind of rural experience and saw the kind of downfalls or the mistakes that the UFW made. And so I think there's this amazing kind of energy and synergy that they're all bringing very different perspectives. And in some ways, I really wanted to focus on these three individuals, but there was a lot of people involved early on who came from these very different backgrounds. And a lot of them who came from sort of these kind of disillusioned backgrounds of the movement in other places, and saw in PECUN or in the WVIP early on an opportunity to kind of correct those mistakes, you know. And so you very early on in the WVIP is talking about imperialism, you know, and the way in which economic imperialism forces migration in the first place. And that's not a place that, like, let the UFW had not gotten to that point,
right?
At this time, you know. And so I think it's something that's persistent, you know. Like, I talk about it towards the end of the book, like, the main most of the organizers for the UFW now are indigenous women, right? And
exactly,
and that's
right.
Who history, and that's who, you know, you can't have a 60-year-old, Jewish guy coming into the nurseries to talk to a bunch of indigenous women. It wouldn't work.
Right.
And so they recognized that and said, the movement wasn't Larry and the movement wasn't Ramon. And they didn't say, well, we're going to have to go in there and organize these people now. They said, no, we got to find people who can organize these people now. Right. And I think that's what, you know, their radio show was a great example of that. And they have, you know, indigenous women on the radio speaking Tiki and Zapotec and these different languages that make their jobs, like, you know, so much easier. It's so much easier to organize that way. And they've just done a remarkable job of being flexible. And I think, you know, when I first started thinking about the contributions that this book would make outside of the academy, that was like the big thing for me, right? It was like people need to see how effective this group is and how well they're working because of their ability to be flexible and to think about, and be self-reflective as well, and to think about who do we need to organize, who has, you know, and who can we get to increase our sort of organizational capacity to do this work.
Right, and it's I had similar feelings when I was reading it as well. It, because for me, what really hit home is the amazing. It seems to me amazing because so much of the movement type scholarship has to deal with movements that evolve and in ways it's addressing the issue of declension and decline and how do you show that these movements and essentially didn't fail. So what I'm talking about, referring to initially, are bigger, broader movements, civil rights, social justice movements. The UFW is often, you know, pointed to in its early successes and then say its latter failures. And in some way, it leads some to really question and evaluate, well, you know, what did the union itself, the UFW I'm referring to here, or other similar movements really accomplish if in the end we have workers, we have people in a very similar situation. But what, you know, your book shows is the influence that and the experience that people who left the UFW and other types of social justice movements, you know, they went on, and you know, there's a number of other scholars that refer to this too. They went on into other organizations, and you know, the WVIP and Pekun for me are just really clear examples of how they really took the good of what they saw would be beneficial from the previous organizing experience, and then, you know, tried, you know, went to a new space and really tried to make it work again. And with Pekun, I was just blown away to, as you close up the book, to read about how strong and powerful that organization is. I'm turning to the page here, but I think it's in the epilogue. You refer to a local politician in Oregon who basically said that they don't do anything without first, running it by Pekun, right?
Yeah, Andy Santos used to work for Governor Kitzhaber in Oregon, and he was like the kind of Latino liaison guy. And when I interviewed him, he's like, "Yeah, we don't do anything. We don't breathe. We don't make a move without first thinking about how's the group going to react to this." And I'm like, to me, it's like you said. I mean, that's like a, what other organization can people say that about? A Latino organization in particular, can people say that about now? Right? I mean, like the UFW is increasingly becoming relevant in the fields and in politics, you know, and so that's not true with Pekun. Like, it's something that, you know, right now Pekun is just got the minimum, you know, was big part of the coalition that got the minimum wage raised in Oregon, you know, and so like that's like a huge, huge boon to farm workers, right? I mean, when we think about the fight for 15, we're often thinking about restaurant workers. People who benefit the most from a raise in minimum wage are farm workers. And so, you know, the UFW, the Pekun, I mean, was a big part of that coalition that just got that passed in Oregon. That story that I tell about the coalition between Pekun and the Basic Rights of Oregon, I think is a really clear example of how Pekun sees the struggle for immigrant rights in a much broader and a much more, all-encompassing kind of avenue, or sort of all-encompassing lens that says, what are the other things that we can do to make the lives of farm workers better besides just winning contracts, right? Because they have about, I want to say right now, probably about 6,500 people under contract, which is not a lot, right? But there's other ways, right? There's other measurements that they use to, like, improve the lives of farm workers, right? Including these leadership training things that they have, right, where they train people to run for, like, school board offices.
Right.
You know what I mean? Like, it's an amazing organization, and I think, you know, I really wanted people to know about it, and I really wanted to see the people to see the history and where it comes from and how it's, how a movement like this is built. You know what I mean?
Certainly. And yeah, no, there's so many lessons in here. And I think among the keys as to how a movement and a successful movement is built, and particularly because the latter chapters of the book really focus on the late 20th century. And that's where it's, I think the, you know, these recent questions and how to organize such diverse movements of, particularly when we're looking at, you know, workers now who, you know, you have, you know, the mixture of the strong components of indigenous workers that come with, you know, various different, you know, backgrounds and cultures and dialects. And so how are you inclusive to that type of a population and not just build an organization that serves them, but then that can build coalitions with other progressive and labor organizations in the region. And again, Pekun is just a striking example. And I was reading again at the epilogue, I mean, talking about the housing projects that they established to create modern apartment like complexes with amenities, child care, a number of things, you know, after school activities. It really is, you know, it was so inspiring for me to read this and so hopeful, you know, as to again to what's possible. And I agree completely that it is a fascinating organization, and it's tremendous that your book was able to, you know, tell a part of their story. We've only touched, you know, just the surface, scratched the surface on what your chapters, latter chapters, really focus on. But it again, truly is, you know, a history that can be learned from.
Yeah, one of the things that I really like with that example that you're talking about, it reminded me of something of, you know, the apartment complex. And when they first started as the WVIP, they, you know, they admitted to themselves that they didn't know much about what was happening. And so they conducted this survey about, you know, asking reforestation workers, like, what are the biggest challenges? And, you know, are you getting paid on time? Like, are you getting sick from, you know, the different pesticides? And, you know, they really, from the very beginning, they take that model from the UFW of, like, you know, what do you need, right? Mm-hmm. Go to the community. Well, one of the great stories about, you know, that farm worker housing development corporation is they do the same thing then, right? 40 years later, they go to the people who are living in those complexes and they say, what do you need, right? And what do you want us to work on? And, you know, we often get these kind of ideas in our heads about, you know, like radical organizing and what it means to be a radical organizer and what it means to be a progressive. And we sort of lose the forest for the trees, and we lose, you know, the kind of on-the-ground thing people need. The number one thing that came back, and it was the survey that was specifically designed for women, was driver education.
Mm-hmm, right.
And it's something that they had never, like, not once did they think of, you know what all farm worker women really need? Is they need driver's license, and they need driver's ed courses, right? And that's not something that, if you're not willing to, like, listen, and you're not willing to ask questions, that's never going to be something that, you know, a 60-year-old Mexican dude is going to come up with, right? Like, it's just not what he's going to come up with. And so the fact that they're able to, like, you know, to not get into their own heads and ask these women what they wanted, and they said driver's license, and then they started talking about why they wanted to be able to drive around, and it's just, you know, the politics of that is just amazing. Mm-hmm. And you're just like, oh, wow. It's, you know, like, our hubris would not have let us see that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, that's right on, and I appreciate you sharing that example as well. And there's a number of others. So our listeners, I strongly encourage them to get a, you know, copy of the book. And it's you know, there's so many broad different applications that I could imagine for it. I mean, of course, outside of the classroom, it's you know, nice, and, you know, it's tightly written. It's you know, but you know, a number of things. I mean, both persuasively written, as a history that drives forth, you know, the theme of worker resistance, but then also, I mean, making these connections to the present and how organizations, can succeed, dealing with, you know, very difficult circumstances of diverse populations, both worker populations, but then working coalitioning through coalitions with other organizations that have similar goals, but, you know, can diverge in tactics. There's just a number of things and lessons that the book points to. We do need to wrap up, but I wanted to also give you maybe a moment to speak about what it is you're working on now. This is, I know it's just off the press, and you're going to spend some time hopefully promoting and sharing the book and getting a lot of people to read it. So, but tell us a little bit on maybe what the next project is, or at least what's occupying your time now.
Well, first, I want to say that I appreciate you talking about, you know, asking me on and talking about the book. And I want to emphasize, you know, the point that you just brought up, and that I try to write the book in a style that made it accessible to the people that I was writing about.
Mm-hmm.
Right? And I thought, for me, that was a really big thing in coming into academia and, you know, not wanting to write something that was just totally, you know, irrelevant to the people who I'm writing about. And so everybody who I, you know, conducted an interview with, it's something that I kept telling myself as I was writing the book. I was saying, okay, you know, I want to make sure that when they read this and they see their faces and they hear their names in the book and read their names in the book, that they understand what's happening and what's being said about them, right? I didn't want to write it in a language where, you know, my what was being said about them was hidden at all. And so I appreciate you mentioning that. That was a big thing for me. As far as what I'm working on now, you know, obviously, like you said, I'm doing other promotions. I'm going to give a couple of talks and, you know, go around the country to talk about the book. But the next book project is sort of similar. I'm working on farm worker communities here in the Central Valley. In particular, I'm writing about a group called the Westland Water District, which is one of the largest irrigation districts. Is the largest irrigation district in the country. It's 600,000 acres owned by just a handful of agribusinesses. And I'm writing about the farm workers who live in these communities, which are, for the most part, unincorporated communities. And so I've been working closely with some activists here in the Central Valley who are living and working in these communities, specifically around access to water,
right?
Clean water, Michigan, access to, you know, they're paying like exorbitant amount of money for their water bills every month, even though their water is essentially unusable.
Mm-hmm.
And what makes it more tragic is that this is water that is essentially paid for by federal tax monies. To essentially bring it down from the Delta through canals into the Westlands Water District, that they get from basically pennies on the gallon, which they then charge, you know, $10-$12 a gallon for usage for these poor communities that are unincorporated. So they don't get water from the city, they don't get water from the county. They have to pay a private organization for water that is gets their water from federally subsidized sources. And so I'm really trying to write the kind of history of this large agribusiness organization and also the lives of the farm workers who live in this area. And so this goes all the way back. The group was founded in the 1950s, started to get federal water in the 1950s. And, you know, sort of talking about some of the struggles against this large agribusiness group, including, interestingly, a progressive white organization called the National Land for People. I shouldn't say white, it was actually very multiracial, but the National Land for People tried to force the federal government to break up these large land holdings in the Westlands Water Districts based on the 1902 Reclamation Act. And so with the 1902 Reclamation was that if you were getting subsidized water from the federal government, you couldn't have a land larger than 160 acres.
Huh.
And so that was on the books until the 1980s. And so the National Land for People tried to and successfully sued the federal government or sued the Westlands Water District to try to break up these large parcels of land. And so that's what I'm writing about now. It's a very complicated story. It's a very long story. But there's also connections to the UFW here. There was a couple named Jesse and Arnoldo de la Cruz who tried to essentially start their own kind of farmers cooperative movement here with farm workers. And so I'm telling a little bit of that story as well. And so, yeah, I mean, I'm very committed to writing about the places that I live. And I think this is the next kind of the next project.
That's awesome. That is so important. And it is, if you're discussing, it's insane to think of what these large, corporations and co-ops are allowed to do with federal water. I mean, whether it's, you know, a corporation like Nestle over in the Midwest that essentially gets federal water almost for free and then bottles it and charges it for exorbitant rates, right, amidst the Flint water crisis or in other issues. But I mean, really just the issue of, you know, community access and, you know, small farmers' access to water is so huge. I think even in the LA Times recently, I read about these big growers that keep drilling, you know, deeper wells that are essentially sucking all the water out of small communities because they're able to get underneath the water table, if you will, of these smaller wells and aquifers and literally, I mean, just drain these communities dry. So it's shocking, and it's a really important work. I'm glad to hear that you're working on that, and I totally agree with your emphasis on and focus on writing history where you are.
Yeah, that LA Times article is exactly about the Westland Water District, the one that you're talking about.
Wow.
So that is what I'm writing about. And I'll be presenting the first kind of iteration of that at AHA PCB in Hawaii this summer. And hopefully some more in next year at AHA and at LAH. We'll see if it gets accepted or not. But that's where the project's going. And there's so much. I mean, the water stuff is so huge right now. And there's so much that I'm having to learn and read and about in terms of, you know, reclamation law and, you know, water law. And like you said, you know, there are no laws to govern drilling for water. So like you said, it's whoever has the most money and whoever sinks the deepest well gets to have it.
Insane. Well, I'm glad. I'm going to be at ACA. Why can I not speak right now? ACA PCB as well in Hawaii. So I'll be looking forward to seeing your presentation. And again, Mario, thanks so much for coming on New Books and Latino Studies. It's been loads of fun and just great to talk to you about your important work.
Yeah, I appreciate you having me on. And I've listened to some of the ones in the past, and there's some really great books. So I appreciate being put in that company.
Certainly, definitely. Well, thanks again.
Yeah.